desperate things befell them after in the great land, that it was lessened in their minds to a thing of less worth. And in sooth, tales that told of the leaving of Valinor were never sweet in the ears of the Noldorli after, were they thralls or citizens of Gondolin. Yet even so such things may not slay the gnome-kin, and of those there lost, still 'tis said some wander sadly there among the ice hills, unknowing of all things that have befallen their folk, and some essayed to get them back to Valinor, and Mandos has them, and some following after, found in long days their unhappy kin again. Howso it be, a gaunt and lessened band indeed did in the end reach the rocky soil of the eastern lands, and there stood looking backward over the ice of Helcaraxa and of Kerkaringa at the spurs of hills beyond the sea, for far away in the gathering southward mists rose those most glorious heights of Valinor, fencing them forever from their kindred and their homes. Thus came the Noldorli into the world. And with those words of Rumil's, the story of the darkening of Valinor was at an end. Great was the power of Melko for ill, saith Ariel, if he could indeed destroy with his cunning the happiness and glory of the gods and of the elves, darkening the light of their hearts no less than of their dwelling, and bringing all their love to naught. This must surely be the worst deed that ever he has done. Of a truth, never has such evil again been done in Valinor, said Lindo, but Melko's hand has laboured at worse things in the world, and the seeds of his evil have waxen since those days to a great and terrible growth. Nay, said Ariel, yet can my heart not think of other griefs, for sorrow at the destruction of those most fair trees, and the darkness of the world. Notes. 1. The manuscript seems certainly to have the form Noldor here. It is to be remembered that in the old story the Teleri, i.e. the later Vanyar, had not departed from Kor. See The Theft of Melko, side 6. 2. At the top of the manuscript page, and fairly clearly referring to Feanor's words, my father wrote, "Increase the element of the desire for Silmaril." Another note refers to the section of the narrative that begins here, and says that it wants a lot of revision. The thirst, lust for jewels, especially for the sacred Silmaril, wants emphasizing, and the all-important battle of Copas Alcalunte, where the gnomes slew the Solosimpi, must be inserted. This note was then struck through and marked done, but only the latter direction was in fact followed. This is the rider on the kinslaughter. 3. Against this, my father wrote in the margin, Helcaraxa Icefang, Kerkaringa the water, see note 5. 4. Helcaraxa or Icefang, earlier reading, Kerkaringa, see note 5. 5. This passage from Know Then, said Lindo, replaces an earlier version which I do not give, for it contains almost nothing that is not in the replacement, and the last sentence of the replacement is a later addition still. It is to be noted, however, that in the first version the neck of land is called Kerkaringa, as also in the replacement passage at first, see note 4, with the remark that the name has also been given to the sound beyond. This, then, was the earlier idea, Kerkaringa, the name primarily of the neck of land, but extended also to the sound, presumably at that stage, Querca did not mean gulf. My father then decided that Kerkaringa was the name of the sound and introduced the name Helcaraxa for the neck of land. Hence the marginal annotation given in note 3 above. At this point he added the last sentence of the replacement passage. Now that strip of water that flowed still between Icefang's tip and the great lands was called Kerkaringa or Chill Gulf. And emended Kerkaringa in the body of the passage, note 4, to Helcaraxa, or Icefang, carrying this change through the rest of the tale. Of Kerkaringa, changed from, of Helcaraxa and of Kerkaringa. 6. For the path down from Mandos, the black ship Mornier and its journey down the coast to Arvalin, See the coming of the Valar, sides 3 and 4. 7. Turondo or Turgon, son of Noleme, has been named previously. The coming of the elves, side 4. 8. The reading Hanstovanen is slightly uncertain, and another name, or, gap in text, Mornian, follows it. See under changes made to names below. 9. After the word dwelling, there is a space left for the insertion of an elvish name. 10. Manuscript Kerkaringa unemended, but clearly the western promontory, the Ice Fang, is referred to, and I therefore read Helcaraxa in the text. See note 5. Changes made to names in the flight of the Noldoli. Helcaraxa, capital H-E-L-K-A-R-A-K-S-E, changed from Kerkaringa, capital Q-E-R-K-A-R-I-N-G-A. For the details of and the explanation of this change, see note 5 above. Arvalin, changed from Habanan. Amnos, capital A-M-N-O-S, changed from Emnon, capital E-M-N-O-N, changed from Morniento, capital M-O-R-N-I-E-N-T-O. Hanstovanen, capital H-A-N-S-T-O-V-A-N-E-N. The name of the beaching place of Mornie was first written Mornielta, capital M-O-R-N-I-E-L-T-A, last letters uncertain, then Vane, capital V-A-N-E, or Vone, capital V-O-N-E, Hansto, capital H-A-N-S-T-O. This latter was not struck out, but the form in the text, which may also be read as Hanstavanen, capital H-A-N-S-T-A-V-A-N-E-N, seems to be the final one. After Hanstovanen follows, or, gap in text, Mornien, capital M-O-R-N-I-E-N. Commentary on the flight of the Noldori. In this tale, in reality the conclusion of the long tale of the theft of Melkor and the darkening of Valinor, told by Lindo and finished by Rumil, is found the oldest account of the departure of the gnomes out of Valinor. Here the gods continue the vain pursuit and search long after Melkor has escaped, and moreover are aided in it by the Eldar, including the Solus Impi, who, as the later Teleri portrayed in the Silmarillion, would hardly have left their shores and their ships. Fëanor's return to Kor and his haranguing of the Noldoli, and in this account others, by the light of their torches, is seen to be an original feature. But his sons have not yet appeared, nor indeed any of the Noldorin princes descended from Finwë, save Turondo, Turgon, of whom it is specifically stated that he was not yet upon the earth. There is no oath of Fëanor, and the later story of the divided councils of the Noldor appears only in the attempt of Noleme, Finwë, to calm the people. Noleme thus playing the later part of Finarfin, the Silmarillion, page 83. In the Silmarillion, after the kinslaying at Alqualondë and the prophecy of the North, Finarfin and many of his people returned to Valinor and were pardoned by the Valar, page 88. But here those few who went back found there was no welcome for them, or else Mandos has them. In the rejected section, which was replaced by the account of the Battle of Copas Alqualuntën, the reference to those deeds which afterwards the Noldoli most bitterly rued must be simply to the theft of the ships of the Solus Impi, since there is no suggestion of any worse actions. In the replacement passage, almost the same words are used of the kinslaying. The actual emergence of the idea that the Noldoli were guilty of worse than theft at Copas is seen in a note in the little book. See the Cottage of Lost Play, side 1, that my father used to jot down thoughts and suggestions, many of these being no more than single sentences or mere isolated names, serving as reminders of work to be done, stories to be told, or changes to be made. This note reads, "The wrath of the gods and elves very great, even let some Noldoli slay some Solus Impi at Copas, and let Ulmo plead for them, if Ulmo so fond of the Solus Impi." This was struck through and marked done, and the recommendation here that Ulmo should plead for the Noldoli is found in the tale of the hiding of Valinor, side 8. In the description of Copas, the mighty arch of living stone survived into the arch of living rock sea-carved in the much briefer description of Alqualondë in the Silmarillion, page 61, and we see here the reason for the havens being lit with many lamps in the same place, because little light came there from the two trees on account of the rock wall around it. though the darkness of Alqualondë is implied by the statement in the Silmarillion that it lay upon the confines of Eldamar, north of Kalakiria, where the light of the stars was bright and clear. The events at the haven were differently conceived in detail from the later story, but still with much general agreement, and though the storm raised by Winan, the Silmarillion, page 87, does not appear in the original version, the picture of the Noldali journeying northward, some along the shore and some in the vessels, remained. There are interesting indications of the geography of the northern regions. There is no suggestion of a great wasteland, later Ahriman, between the northern mountains of Valinor and the sea, a conclusion reached earlier, the coming of the Valar, side 3, and supported incidentally by the accounts of the steep path from Mandos in the mountains down to the beaching place of the black ship, Mornier, the coming of the Valar, side 3. The name Helcaraxe Icefang, first appearing in emendations to the text, and given to the neck or promontory running out from the western land, was afterwards reapplied to what is here called Kerkeringa, the strait filled with ice floes that grind and crash together, but this was when the Helcaraxe, the grinding ice, had come to have a quite different geographical significance in the much more sophisticated world picture that my father evolved during the next phase of the mythology. In the Silmarillion, page 87, there is a suggestion that the speaker of the prophecy of the North was Mandos himself, and no lesser herald of Manwë, and its gravity, indeed its centrality in the mythology, is far greater. Here there is no suggestion of a doom or curse, but only a foretelling. This foretelling included the dark words, "Great is the fall of Gondolin." In the tale of the fall of Gondolin, but in an interpolated sentence very possibly later than the present tale, Turgon, standing upon the stairs of his palace amid the destruction of the city, uttered these same words, and men shuddered, for such were the words of Amnon, the prophet of old. Here, Amnon, rather than Amnos, as in the present text, itself an emendation from Amnon, is not a place but a person, the servant of Befantur, who uttered the prophecy. In the little notebook referred to above occurs the following jotting. Prophecy of Amnon, great is the fall of Gondolin. Lo, Turgon shall not fade till the lily of the valley fadeth. In some other notes for the lost tales, this takes the form, prophecy of Amnon, great is the fall of Gondolin, and when the lily of the valley withers, then shall Turgon fade. In these notes, Amnon might be either place or person. The lily of the valley is Gondolin itself, one of whose seven names was Lothengriol, later Lothengriol, which is translated Flower of the Vale or Lily of the Valley. There is an interesting statement in the old story that the Noldali would never have passed the ice if they had yet been subject to the weariness, sickness, and the many weaknesses that after became their lot, dwelling far from Valinor. But still was the blessed food of the gods and their drink rich in their veins, and they were half divine. This is echoed in the words of the Silmarillion, page 90, that the Noldor were but new come from the blessed realm, and not yet weary with the weariness of earth. On the other hand, it was specifically said in the prophecy of the North, in the same place, page 88, that though Eru appointed you to die not in Ea, and no sickness may assail you, yet slain ye may be, and slain ye shall be, etc. Of the treachery of the Feanorians sailing away in the ships, and leaving the host of Fingolfin on the shores of Ahriman, there is, of course, in the old story, no trace, but the blaming of Feanor was already present, the tense of murmuring. It is a remarkable aspect of the earliest version of the mythology, that while so much of the narrative structure was firm and was to endure, the later genealogical structure had scarcely emerged. Turgon existed as the son of Finwë Nolëme, but there is no suggestion that Feanor was close akin to the lord of the Noldali, and the other princes, Fingolfin, Finarfin, Fingon, Felagund, do not appear at all in any form or by any name. 8. The Tale of the Sun and Moon. Introduction. The tale of the sun and moon is introduced by an interlude, as it is called in the manuscript, in which there appears as a guest at Marvanwa Chyalyeva one Gilfanan of Tavrobel. This interlude exists also in a rejected earlier version. The tale itself is for most of its length a manuscript in ink over an erased, penciled original, but towards its end, see note 19, it becomes a primary manuscript in ink with the penciled draft extant in another book. The tale of the sun and moon is very long, and I have shortened it in places in brief paraphrase, without omitting any detail of interest. A note of my father's refers to this tale as in need of great revision, cutting down, and reshaping. The Tale of the Sun and Moon. Gilfanan a Davrobel. Now it is not to be thought that as Ariel hearkened to many tales which spake of divers sorrows of the elves, that the thirst for Limpe grew less within him, for it was not so, and ever as the throng sat about the tale fire, he was an eager questioner, seeking to learn all the history of the folk, even down to those days that then were, when the elfin people dwelt again together in the isle. Knowing now, therefore, something of the glorious fashion of their ancient home, and of the splendour of the gods, he pondered often on the coming of the days of sunlight, and of moon-sheen, and of the doings of the elves in the world without, and of their adventures there with men ere Merko compassed their estrangement. Wherefore, one night he said, sitting before the tale-fire, "Whence be the sun and moon, O Lindo? For as yet have I heard only of the two trees and their sad fading, but of the coming of men, or of the deeds of the elves beyond Valinor, has no one told me." Now there happened that night to be present a guest both at their board and at their tale-telling, and his name was Gilfanan, and all named him beside Gilfanan a Davrobel, note 1, for he came from that region of the isle where stands the tower of Tavrobel, beside the rivers, note 2, and about it dwelt the gnome folk still as one people, naming the places in their own tongue. That region was Gilfanan wont to name the fairest of all the isle, and the gnome kin its best folk. Albeit ere the coming of the folk thither, long had he dwelt away from the Noldoli, faring with Ilcorins in Hisilome and Artanor, note 3, and thereto had he become, as few elves did, a great friend and companion of the children of men of those days. To their legends and their memories he added his own knowledge, for he had been deep versed in many laws and tongues once in the far days of Kor, and experience had he beside of many very ancient deeds, being indeed one of the oldest of the fairies, note 4, and the most aged that now dwelt in the isle, albeit Meryl held the title of Lady of the Isle by reason of her blood. Therefore, said Lindo now, answering Ariel, "Behold, Gilfanan here can tell thee much of such matters, and it were well if you fared hence away with him, to sojourn a while in Tavrobel." "Nay, look not thus," he laughed, seeing Ariel's face, "for we do not banish thee yet, but of a sooth he who would drink of Limpe were wise first, to seek the guest kindliness of Gilfanan, in whose ancient house, the House of the Hundred Chimneys that stands nigh the bridge of Tavrobel, note 5, may many things be heard of, both past and that are to come." End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 7. The Book of Lost Tales, Part 1, continuing with The Tale of the Sun and Moon, on page 175. "Methinks," said Gilfanan to Ariel, "that Lindo seeks to rid himself of two guests at once. Howso, he may not do so yet, for I purpose to stay in Quartirion a sennight yet, and moreover to feast at his good board meanwhile, and stretch me by the tail fire too. Thereafter, maybe thou and I will fare away, and thou shalt see the full loveliness of the fairy's isle. But now let Lindo raise up his voice, and tell us yet more of the splendour of the gods and their works, a theme that never wearies him." At that was Lindo well pleased, for of a truth he loved to tell such tales, and sought often an occasion for recalling them. Then said he, "Then will I tell the story of the sun and moon and of the stars, that Ariel may hearken to his desire." And Ariel was well pleased. But Gilfanon said, "Speak on, my Lindo, yet lengthen not the tale forever." Then did Lindo lift up his voice, note 6, and it was the most pleasant to hearken to of all tale-tellers, and he said, footnote, written in the margin, "beginning of the sun and moon," end of footnote. "A tale I tell of that time of the first flight of the gnomes, and behold, they are but newly fled. Now came that grievous news to the gods and the other elves, and at first none believed. Nonetheless, the tidings came still unto them, and by many different messengers. Some were of the Teleri, who had heard the speech of Feanor in the square of Kor, and had seen the Noldoli depart thence with all the goods they might convey. Others were of the Solosimpi, and these brought the dire tidings of the swan ship's rape, and the dread kinslaughter of the haven, and the blood that lay on the white shores of Alcalunte. Lastly came some hotfoot from Mandos, who had gazed upon that sad throng nigh the strands of Amnor, and the gods knew that the gnomes were far abroad, and Vardr and all the elves wept, for now seemed the darkness black indeed, and that more than the outward light of the fair trees was slain. Strange is to tell that albeit Aule had loved the Noldoli above all the elves, and had taught them all they knew, and given them great stores of wealth, now was his heart most turned against them. For he deemed them ingrate, in that they had bidden him no farewell, and for their ill deeds among the Solosimpi he was grieved to the heart. "Speak not," said he, "the name of the Noldoli ever again unto me." And albeit he gave still his love to those few faithful gnomes, who remained still about his halls, yet did he name them thereafter Eldar. But the Teleri and the Solosimpi, having wept at first, when the onslaught of the haven became known to all, dried their tears, and horror and anguish held their hearts. And they too spake seldom of the Noldoli, save sadly or in whispers behind closed doors. And those few of the Noldoli that remained behind were named the Aulanosse, or kindred of Aule, or were taken into the other kindreds, and the gnome folk has no place or name remaining now in all Valinor. Now is it to tell that after a great while it seemed to Manwë that the hunt of the gods availed nothing, and that surely Melko is now escaped out of Valinor. Wherefore he sent Sorontur into the world, and Sorontur came not back for long, and still Tulkas and many others ranged the land, but Manwë stood beside the darkened trees, and his heart was very heavy as he pondered deep and gloomily, but at that time could he see little light of hope. Suddenly there is a sound of wings in that place, for Sorontur, king of eagles, is come again on strong wings through the dusk, and behold, alighting on the boughs of darkened Silpion, he tells how Melko is now broken into the world, and many evil spirits are gathered to him. "But," quoth he, "methinks nevermore will Utumna open unto him, and already is he busy making himself new dwellings in that region of the north where stand the iron mountains, very high and terrible to see. Yet, O Manwë, lord of the air, other tidings have I also for thy ear, for lo, as I winged my way homeward hither over the black seas and over the unkindly lands, a sight I saw of greatest wonder and amaze. A fleet of white ships that drifted empty in the gales, and some were burning with bright fires, and as I marvelled, behold, I saw a great concourse of folk upon the shores of the great lands, and they gazed all westward, but some were still wandering in the ice. For know, this was at that place where are the crags of Helcaraxe, and the murderous waters of Kerkeringa flowed of old, which now are stopped with ice. Swooping, methought I heard the sound of wailing and of sad words spoken in the Eldar tongue, and this tale do I bring to thee for thy unravelling." But Manwë knew thereby that the Noldoli were gone forever, and their ships burned or abandoned, and Melko too was in the world, and the hunt of no avail. And belike it is in memory of those deeds that it has ever been a saying in the mouths of elves and men, that those burn their boats who put all hope from them of change of mind or counsel. Therefore now Manwë lifted up his unmeasurable voice, calling to the gods, and all those about the wide lands of Valinor hearkened and returned. There first came Tulkas, weary and dust-covered, for none had leapt about that plain as he. 7 times had he encompassed all its width, and 3 had he scaled the mountain wall, and all those measureless slopes and pastures, meads and forests he had traversed, burnt by his desire to punish the spoiler of Valinor. There came Lórien, and leaned against the withered bole of Silpion, and wept the wrack of his quiet gardens by the trampling hunt. There too was Maeasean with her Makar, and his hand was red, for he had come upon 2 of Melko's comrades as they fled, and he slew them as they ran, and he alone had aught of joy in those ill times. Asse was there, and his beard of green was torn, and his eyes were dim, and he gasped, leaning on a staff, and was very much athirst, for mighty as he was about the seas, and tireless, such desperate travail on the bosom of earth spent his vigour utterly. Salmar and Omar stood by, and their instruments of music made no sound, and they were heavy of heart, yet not so bitterly as was Aule, lover of the earth and of all things made or gained by good labour therefrom, for of all the gods he had loved Valmar most wholly, and Kor and all their treasures, and the smile of the fair plains without, and its ruin cut his heart. With him was Yavanna, Earth Queen, and she had hunted with the gods, and was spent. But Vanna and Nessa wept as maidens still beside the founts of gold Cululin. Ulmo alone came not to the trees, but went down to the beach of Eldamar, and there he stood, gazing into the gloom far out to sea. And he called often with his most mighty voice, as though he would draw back those truants to the bosom of the gods, and whiles he played deep longing music on his magic conches, and to him alone, lest it be, note 7, Varda, Lady of the Stars, was the going of the gnomes a greater grief than even the ruin of the trees. Aforetime had Ulmo loved the Solus Impi very dearly, yet when he heard of their slaughter by the gnomes, he grieved indeed, but anger hardened not his heart. For Ulmo was foreknowing more than all the gods, even than great Manwë, and perchance he saw many of the things that should spring from that flight, and the dread pains of the unhappy Noldali and the world, and the anguish wherewith they would expiate the blood of Kopas, and he would that it need not be. Now when all were thus come together, then spake Manwë to them, and told the tidings of Sorontur, and how the chase had failed. But at that time the gods were wildered in the gloom, and had little counsel, and sought each one his home and places of old delight, now dead, and there sat in silence and dark, pondering. Yet some fared ever and anon out upon the plain, and gazed wistfully at the faded trees, as though those withered boughs would one day burgeon with new light. But this came not to pass, and Valinor was full of shadows and of gloom. And the elves wept and could not be comforted, and the Noldali had bitter sorrow in the northern land. Thereafter, in a great time, it pierced the grief and the weariness of the gods, that light is gone from Valinor forever, and that never again will those trees bloom again at their appointed times. Only the light of the stars remained, save where a glow lay about the fountain of Cululin, playing still, or a pale gleam lingered nigh deep Telimpe. Note 8, Vat of Dreams. Yet even these were dimmed and tarnished, for the trees bore dew no more for their replenishment. Wherefore does Vanna arise and seek Lórien, and with them go Orwendi and Silmo, note 9, and many of both Vali and the elves. And they gather much light of gold and silver in great vessels, and fare sadly to the ruined trees. There singeth Lórien most wistful songs of magic and enchantment, about the stock of Silpion, and he bid water his roots with the radiance of Telimpe. And this was lavishly done, albeit small store thereof remained now in the dwellings of the gods. In like manner doth Vanna, and she sings old golden songs of the happier days, and bids her maidens dance their bright dances, even such as they were used to dance upon the sward of the rose gardens nigh Cululin. And as they danced, she flooded the roots of Laurelin with streams from out her golden jars. Yet all their singing and enchantment is of little worth, and though the roots of the trees seem to drink all that they may pour, yet can they see no stir of life renewed, nor faintest gleam of light. Nor withered leaf glows with sap, nor blossom lifts its drooping stem. Indeed, in the frenzy of their grief they had poured out all the last remaining stores of brightness that the gods retained, had not of a fortune Manwe and Aule come upon them in that hour, being drawn thither by their singing in the gloom, and stayed them, saying, "Lo, O Vana, and thou, O Lorien, what is this rashness? And wherefore did ye not first take counsel of your brethren? For know ye not that that which ye spill unthinking upon the earth is become more precious than all the things the world contains? And when it is gone, perchance not all the wisdom of the gods may get us more." Then Vana said, "Pardon, O Manwe Sulimo, and let my sorrow and my tears be my excuse. Yet aforetime did this draught fail never to refresh the heart of Laurelin, and she bare ever in return a fruit of light more plentiful than we gave. And methought the gods sat darkly in their halls, and for the weight of their grief essayed no remedy of their ills. But behold, now have Lorien and I put forth our spells, and naught may they avail." And Vana wept. Now was it the thought of many that those twain, Lorien and Vana, might not avail to heal the wounds of Laurelin and Silpion, in that no word of the Earth Lady, Mother of Magics, was mingled in their spells. Therefore many said, "Let us seek Palurien, for of her magic maybe these trees shall again know some portion of their ancient glory, and then, if light be renewed, Aule and his craftsmen may repair the hurts of our fair realm, and happiness will be once more twixt Erumani and the sea." Note 10. But of the darkness and ill days that had long been without the hills, few recked or thought. Now therefore they called for Yavanna, and she came and asked them what they would. And hearing, she wept and spake before them, saying, "Know ye, O Valar, and ye sons and daughters of the Eldar, children of Ilúvatar, first offspring of the forests of the earth, that never may these two trees bloom again, and others like them may not be brought to life for many, many ages of the world. Many things shall be done and come to pass, and the gods grow old, and the elves come nigh to fading, ere ye shall see the rekindling of these trees, or the magic sun relit." And the gods knew not what she meant, speaking of the magic sun, nor did for a long while after. But Tulkas, hearing, said, "Why speakest thou these words, O Kemi Palurien, for foretelling is not thy wont, and that of evil least of all?" And others there were who said, "Aye, and never before has Kemi the Earth Lady been hard of counsel, or lacked the spell of deepest virtue." And they besought her to put forth her power. But Yavanna said, "'Tis of fate and the music of the Ainur. Such marvels as those trees of gold and silver may even the gods make but once, and that in the youth of the world, nor may all my spells avail to do what ye now ask." Then said Vana, "How then sayest thou, Aule, mighty contriver, who art called Italka Marda, smith of the world, for the might of thy works? How are we to obtain light that is needful to our joy? For what is Valinor without light? Or what art thou, and thou losest thy skill, as meseems, in this hour thy spouse has done?" "Nay," said Aule, "light may not be fashioned by smithcraft, O Vana Lysi, nor can any even of the gods devise it, if the sap of the trees of wonder be dried forever." But Palurien answering also said, "Lo, O Tuivana, and ye beside of the valley and of the elves, think ye only and always of Valinor, forgetting the world without? For my heart saith to me that already were it time for the gods to take up once more the battle for the world, and expel therefrom the powers of Melko, ere they be waxen to o'erwhelming strength." But Vana comprehended not Palurian's mind, thinking only of her tree of gold, and she abode ill-content. But Manwe and Varda, and with them Aule and Yavanna, fared thence, and in secret conclave, they took deep and searching counsel one of another, and at the last they bethought them of a reed of hope. Then did Manwë call together all the folk of Valinor once more, and that great throng was gathered even in Varna's bower amidst her roses, where Cululin's fountains were, for the plain without lay now all cold and dark. There came even the leaders of the elves, and sat at the feet of the gods, nor had that before been done. But when all were come together, Aule arose and said, "Hearken ye all. A reed has Manwë Sulimo Valaturu to declare, and the mind of the Earth Lady and of the Queen of the Stars is therein, nor yet is my counsel absent." Footnote, Valaturu, in margin, also Valahiru. End of footnote. Then was there a great silence that Manwë might speak, and he said, "Behold, O my people, a time of darkness has come upon us, and yet I have it in mind that this is not without the desire of Ilúvatar. For the gods had well nigh forgot the world that lies without, expectant of better days, and of men, Ilúvatar's youngest sons that soon must come. Now therefore are the trees withered, that so filled our land with loveliness and our hearts with mirth, that wider desires came not into them, and so behold, we must turn now our thoughts to new devices, whereby light may be shed upon both the world without and Valinor within." Then told he them concerning those stores of radiance they still possessed, for of silver light they had no great store, save only that that yet lay in Telimpe, and a lesser measure that Aule had in basins in his smithy. Some indeed had the Eldar lovingly saved in tiny vessels, as it flowed and wasted in the soils about the stricken bowl, but it was little enough. Now the smallness of their store of white light was due to many causes, in that Varda had used greatly of it when she kindled mighty stars about the heavens, both at the coming of the Eldar and at other times. Moreover, that tree Silpion bore dew of light less richly far than Laurelin had been wont to do, and nonetheless, for it was less hot and fiery subtle, did the gods and elves have need of it always in their magic crafts, and had mingled it with all manner of things that they devised, and in this were the Noldoli the chief. Now golden light not even the gods could tame much to their uses, and had suffered it to gather in the great vat Cululin to the great increase of its fountains, or in other bright basins and wide pools about their courts, for the health and glory of its radiance was very great. 'Tis said, indeed, that those first makers of jewels, of whom Feanor has the greatest fame, alone of the Eldar knew the secret of subtly taming golden light to their uses, and they dared use their knowledge but very sparingly, and now is that perished with them out of the earth. Yet even of this golden radiance was there no unfailing source, now that Laurelin dripped her sweet dew no more. Of this necessity did Manwë shape his plan, and it was caught from that very sowing of the stars that Varda did of yore, for to each of the stars had she given a heart of silver flame, set in vessels of crystals and pale glass, and unimagined substances of faintest colours. And these vessels, were some made like to boats, and buoyed by their hearts of light, they fared ever about Ilúvatar. Yet could they not soar into the dark and tenuous realm of Vaitia, that is outside all. Now winged spirits of the utmost purity and beauty, even the most ethereal of those bright choirs of the Mánir and the Súruli, who fare about the halls of Manwë on Taniquetil, or traverse all the airs that move upon the world, sat in those starry boats, and guided them on mazy courses high above the earth, and Varda gave them names, but few of these are known. Others there were, whose vessels were like translucent lamps, set quivering above the world, in Ilúvatar, or on the very confines of Vilna and the airs we breathe, and they flickered and waned for the stirring of the upper winds, yet abode where they hung and moved not. And of these some were very great and beautiful, and the gods and elves among all their riches loved them. And thence indeed the jewel-makers catch their inspiration. Not least did they love Morwinian of the West, whose name meaneth the glint at dusk, and of his setting in the heavens much has been told. And of Njelwin, too, who is the bee of Asia, Njelwin, whom still may all men see in autumn or in winter, burning nigh the foot of Telemektar, son of Tulkas, whose tale is yet to tell. But lo, said Lindo, the beauty of the stars hath drawn me far afield, and yet I doubt not in that great speech the mightiest Manwe ever spake before the gods, mention he made of them yet more loving than was mine. For behold, he desired in this manner to bring the hearts of the gods to consider his design, and having spoken of the stars, he shaped thus his final words. Behold, said Manwe, this is now the third essay of the gods to bring light into dark places, and both the lamps of the north and south, and the trees of the plain, Melko hath brought to ruin. Now in the air only hath Melko no power for ill, wherefore it is my rede that we build a great vessel, brimming with golden light, and the hoarded dews of Laurelin, and this do set afloat like a mighty ship, high above the dark realms of the earth. There shall it thread far courses through the airs, and pour its light on all the world, twixt Valinore and the eastern shores. Now Manwë designed the course of the ship of light to be between the east and west, for Melko held the north, and Ungweliant the south, whereas in the west was Valinor and the blessed realms, and in the east great regions of dark lands that crave for light. Now it is said, quoth Lindo, that whereas certain of the gods of their divine being might, and they wished, fare with a great suddenness of speed through Vilna and the low airs, yet might none even of the Valar, not Melko himself, nor any other save Manwë and Varda, and their folk alone, avail to pass beyond. For this was the word of Ilúvatar, when he sped them to the world at their desire, that they should dwell forever within the world if once they entered it, nor should leave it, until its great end came, being woven about it in the threads of its fate, and becoming part thereof. Yet more, to Manwë alone, knowing the purity and glory of his heart, did Ilúvatar grant the power of visiting the uttermost heights, and breathing the great clear serene, which lies so far above the world that no finest dust of it, nor thinnest odour of its lives, nor faintest echo of its song or sorrow comes there. But far below it gleams palely beneath the stars, and the shadows of the sun and moon, faring back and forth from Valinor, flutter upon its face. There walks Manwë Sulimo often far out beyond the stars, and watches it with love, and he is very near the heart of Ilúvatar. But this has ever been, and is yet, the greatest bitterness to Melko, for in no wise of himself could he now forsake the bosom of the earth, and belike ye shall yet hear how mightily his envy was increased when the great vessels of radiance set sail. But now is it to tell that so moving were the words, and so great their wisdom that, note 11, the most part of the gods thought his purpose good, and they said, let Aule busy himself then with all his folk in the fashioning of this ship of light. And few said otherwise, though 'tis told that Lórien was little pleased, fearing lest shadow and quiet and secret places ceased to be, and of a surety Vana might think of little else for the greatness of her vain desire to see the rekindling of the trees. Then said Aule, the task ye set me is of the utmost difficulty, yet will I do all that I may therein. And he begged the aid of Varda the star-fashioner, and those twain departed, and were lost in the gloom a great while. Editor's note. The narrative continues with an account of the failure of Aule and Varda to devise any substance that was not too gross to swim the airs, or too frail to bear the radiance of Cululin. And when this was made known, Vana and Lórien asked that since Manwe's design had failed, he should command Yavanna to attempt the healing of the trees. End of editor's note. At length, therefore, did Manwë bid Yavanna to put forth her power, and she was loath, but the clamour of the folk constrained her, and she begged for some of the radiance of white and gold. But of this would Manwë and Aule spare only two small phials, saying that if the draught of old had power to heal the trees, already had they been blooming, for Vana and Lórien had poured it unstintingly upon their roots. Then sorrowfully Yavanna stood upon the plain, and her form trembled, and her face was very pale for the greatness of the effort that her being put forth, striving against fate. The phial of gold she held in her right hand, and the silver in her left, and standing between the trees, she lifted them on high, and flames of red and of white arose from each like flowers, and the ground shook, and the earth opened, and a growth of flowers and plants leapt up therefrom about her feet, white and blue about her left side, and red and gold about her right, and the gods sat still and in amaze. Then going, she cast each phial upon its proper tree, and sang the songs of unfading growth, and a song of resurrection after death and withering. And suddenly she sang no more. Midway she stood between the trees, and utter silence fell. Then there was a great noise heard, and none knew what passed, but Palurian lay swooning on the earth, and many leapt beside her and raised her from the ground, and she trembled and was afraid. "Vain, O children of the gods," she cried, "is all my strength. Lo, at your desire I have poured my power upon the earth like water, and like water the earth has sucked it from me. It is gone, and I can do no more." And the trees stood still gaunt and stark, and all the companies wept, beholding her. But Manwë said, "Weep not, O children of the gods, the irreparable harm, for many fair deeds, may be yet to do, and beauty hath not perished on the earth, nor all the counsels of the gods been turned to naught." But nonetheless folk left that place in sorrow, save Vana only, and she clung to the bole of Laurelin and wept. Now is the time of faintest hope and darkness most profound fallen on Valinor that was ever yet. And still did Vana weep, and she twined her golden hair about the bole of Laurelin, and her tears dropped softly at its roots. And even as the dew of her gentle love touched that tree, behold, a sudden pale gleam was born in those dark places. Then gazed Vana in wonder, and even where her first tears fell, a shoot sprang from Laurelin, and it budded, and the buds were all of gold, and there came light therefrom, like a ray of sunlight beneath a cloud. Then sped Vana a little way out upon the plain, and she lifted up her sweet voice with all her power, and it came trembling faintly to the gates of Valmar, and all the Valar heard. Then said Omar, "'Tis the voice of Vana's lamentation." But Salmar said, "Nay, listen more, for rather is there joy in that sound." And all that stood by hearkened, and the words they heard were, "E Calantulian, light hath returned." Loud then was the murmur about the streets of Valmar, and folk sped thronging over the plain, and when they beheld Vana beneath the tree, and the new shoot of gold, then suddenly did a song of very mighty praise and joy burst forth on every tongue. And Tulkas said, "Lo, mightier have the spells of Yavanna proved than her foretelling." But Yavanna, gazing upon Vana's face, said, "Alas, 'tis not so, for in this have my spells played but a lesser part, and more potent has the gentle love of Vana been, and her falling tears a dew more healing and more tender than all the radiance of old. Yet, as for my foretelling, soon wilt thou see, O Tulkas, if thou dost but watch." Then did all the folk gaze on Laurelin, and behold, those buds opened and put forth leaves, and these were of finest gold, and of other kind to those of old. And even as they watched, the branch bore golden blossom, and it was thronged with flowers. Now as swiftly as its blossoms opened full, it seemed a gust of wind came suddenly, and shook them from their slender stems, blowing them about the heads of those that watched like jets of fire, and folk thought there was evil in that. But many of the Eldar chased those shining petals far and wide, and gathered them in baskets. Yet save such as were of golden threads or of other metals, these might not contain those ardent blooms, and were all consumed and burnt, that the petals were lost again. One flower there was, however, greater than the others, more shining and more richly golden, and it swayed to the winds, but fell not. And it grew, and as it grew of its own radiant warmth, it fructified. Then as its petals fell and were treasured, a fruit there was of great beauty, hanging from that bough of Laurelin. But the leaves of the bough grew sere, and they shriveled and shone no more. Even as they dropped to earth, the fruit waxed wonderfully, for all the sap and radiance of the dying tree were in it, and the juices of that fruit were like quivering flames of amber and of red, and its pips like shining gold, but its rind was of a perfect lucency, smooth as a glass whose nature is transfused with gold, and therethrough the moving of its juices could be seen within, like throbbing furnace fires. So great became the light and richness of that growth, and the weight of its fruitfulness, that the bough bent thereunder, and it hung as a globe of fires before their eyes. Then said Yavanna to Aule, "Bear thou up the branch, my lord, lest it snap, and the fruit of wonder be dashed rudely to the ground. And the greatest ruth would that be, for know ye all that this is the last flame of life that Laurelin shall show." But Aule had stood by as one lost in sudden thought, since first that fruit came to ripening, and he answered now, saying, "Very long indeed did Varda and I seek through the desolate homes and gardens for materials of our craft. Now do I know that Ilúvatar has brought my desire into my hand." Then calling to Tulkas to aid him, he severed the stem of that fruit, and they that behold gasped and were astonished at his ruthlessness. Loudly they murmured, and some cried, "Woe to him that ravishes anew our tree!" And Vana was in great ire. Yet did none dare to draw nigh, for those twain, Aule and Tulkas, might scarcely bear up even upon their godlike shoulders that great globe of flame, and were tottering beneath it. Hearing their anger indeed, Aule stayed, saying, "Cease, ye of little wisdom, and have a patience." But even with those words his foot went astray, and he stumbled, and even Tulkas might not bear that fruit alone, so that it fell, and striking stony ground, burst asunder. Straightway such a blinding radiance leapt forth, as even the full bloom of Laurelin had not yielded of old, and the darkened eyes of the valley were dazzled, so that they fell back, stunned. But a pillar of light rose from that place, smiting the heavens that the stars paled above it, and the face of Taniquetil went red afar off, and Aule alone of all those there was unmoved by sorrow. Then said Aule, "Of this can I make a ship of light, surpassing even the desire of Manwe." And now Varda and many others, even Vana, understood his purpose and were glad. But they made a mighty corbel of twisted gold, and strewing it with ardent petals of its own bloom, they laid therein the halves of the fruit of noon, and uplifting it with many hands, bore it away with much singing and great hope. Then coming to the courts of Aule, they set it down, and thereupon began the great smithying of the sun, and this was the most cunning marvellous of all the works of Aule Talcamarda, whose works are legion. Of that perfect rind a vessel did he make, diaphanous and shining, yet of a tempered strength, for with spells of his own he overcame its brittleness, nor in any way was its subtle delicacy thereby diminished. Now the most ardent radiance poured therein, neither spilled nor dimmed, nor did that vessel receive any injury therefrom, yet would it swim the airs more lightly than a bird. And Aule was overjoyed, and he fashioned that vessel like a great ship, broad of beam, laying one half of the rind within the other, so that its strength might not be broken. Editor's note. There follows an account of how Vana, repenting of her past murmurings, cut short her golden hair and gave it to the gods, and from her hair they wove sails and ropes, more strong than any mariner hath seen, yet of the slenderness of gossamer. The masts and spars of the ship were all of gold. End of editor's note. Then, that the ship of the heavens might be made ready unto the last, the unfading petals of the latest flower of Laurelin were gathered like a star at her prow, and tassels and streamers of glancing light were hung about her bulwarks, and a flash of lightning was caught in her mast to be a pennant. But all that vessel was filled to the brim with the blazing radiance of gold Kululin, and mingled therein drops of the juices of the fruit of noon, and these were very hot, and thereafter scarcely might the bosom of the earth withhold her, and she leapt at her cords like a captive bird that listeth for the airs. Then did the gods name that ship, and they called her Sari, which is the sun,
but the elves Ur, which is fire. Note 12. But many other names does she bear in legend and in poesy. The lamp of Vana is she named among the gods, in memory of Vana's tears and her sweet tresses that she gave, and the gnomes call her Garmia, the gold gleamer, note 13, and Glorvent, the ship of gold, and Braglorin, the blazing vessel, and many a name beside. And her names among men, no man has counted them. Behold, now it is to be told, how while that galleon was a-building, others, nigh to where the two trees once grew, fashioned a great basin, and folk laboured mightily at it. Its floor they made of gold, and its walls of polished bronze, and an arcade of golden pillars topped with fires engirdled it, save only on the east. But Yavanna set a great and nameless spell around it, so that therein was poured the most of the waters of the fruit of noon, and it became a bath of fire. Indeed, is it not called Tanyasalpe, the bowl of fire, even Faskala Numen, the bath of the setting sun? For here, when Urwendi, after return from the east, and the first sunset came on Valinor, the ship was drawn down, and its radiance refreshed against new voyagings on the morrow, while the moon held high heaven. Now the making of this place of fire is more wondrous than seems, for so subtle were those radiances that set in the air, they spilled not nor sank. Nay, rather they rose and floated away far above Vilna, being of the utmost buoyancy and lightness. Yet now did naught escape from Faskalan, which burnt amid the plain, and light came to Valinor therefrom, yet by reason of the deepness of the basin, it fared not far abroad, and the ring of shadows stood close in. Then said Manwë, looking upon the glory of that ship as it strained to be away, "Who shall steer us this boat, and guide its course above the realms of earth? For even the holy bodies of the Valar, meseems, may not for long endure to bathe in this great light." But a great thought came into the heart of Urwendi, and she said that she was not adread, and begged leave to become the mistress of the sun, and to make herself ready for that office as Ilúvatar set it in her heart to do. Then did she bid a many of her maidens follow her, even of those who had aforetime watered the roots of Laurelin with light, and casting aside their raiment, they went down into that pool Faskalan as bathers into the sea, and its golden foams went over their bodies, and the gods saw them not, and were afraid. But after a while they came again to the brazen shores, and were not as before, for their bodies were grown lucent, and shone as with an ardour within, and light flashed from their limbs as they moved, nor might any raiment endure to cover their glorious bodies any more. Like air they were, and they trod as lightly as does sunlight on the earth, and saying no word they climbed upon the ship, and that vessel heaved against its great cords, and all the folk of Valinor might scarce restrain it. Now at last, by Manwë's command, do they climb the long slopes of Taniquetil, and draw Icalavente, the ship of light, along with them, nor is that any great task. And now do they stand on the wide space before great Manwë's doors, and the ship is on the western slope of the mountain, trembling and tugging at its bonds, and already so great is its glory become, that sunbeams pour out over the shoulders of Taniquetil, and a new light is in the sky, and the waters of the shadowy seas beyond are touched with such fire as they never yet had seen. In that hour it is said that all creatures that wandered in the world stood still and wondered, even as Manwë going spake to Urwendi and said, "Go now, most wondrous maiden washed in fire, and steer the ship of divine light above the world, that joy may search out its narrowest crannies, and all the things that sleep within its bosom may awake." Note 14. But Urwendi answered not, looking only eagerly to the east, and Manwë bade cast the ropes that held her, and straightway the ship of the morning arose above Taniquetil, and the bosom of the air received it. Ever as it rose it burned the brighter and the purer, till all Valinor was filled with radiance, and the vales of Erumani and the shadowy seas were bathed in light, and sunshine was spilled on the dark plain of Arvalin, save only where Ungueliante's clinging webs and darkest fumes
still lay too thick for any radiance to filter through. Then all, looking up, saw that heaven was blue, and very bright and beautiful, but the stars fled as that great dawn came upon the world, and a gentle wind blew from the cold lands to meet the vessel, and filled its gleaming sails, and white vapours mounted from off the misty seas below toward her, that her prow seemed to cleave a white and airy foam. Yet did she waver not, for the mannier that fared about her drew her by golden cords, and higher the sun's great galleon arose, until even to the sight of Manwë it was but a disk of fire, wreathed in veils of splendour, that slowly and majestically wandered from the west. Now ever, as it drew further on its way, so grew the light in Valinor more mellow, and the shadows of the houses of the gods grew long, slanting away towards the waters of the outer seas. But Taniquetil threw a great westering shadow that waxed ever longer and deeper, and it was afternoon in Valinor. Then said Gilfanan, laughing, "Nay, but, good sir, you lengthen the tale mightily, for methinks you love to dwell upon the works and deeds of the great gods. But an you set not a measure to your words, our stranger here will live not to hear of those things that happened in the world, when at length the gods gave to it the light they so long had withholden. And such tales, methinks, were a variety pleasing to hear." But Eriol had of a sooth been listening very eagerly to the sweet voice of Lindo, and he said, "But a little while agone, a day perchance, the Eldar would esteem it, did I come hither. Yet no longer do I love the name of stranger, neither will Lindo ever lengthen the tale beyond my liking, whatsoever he tells. But behold, this history is all to my heart." But Lindo said, "Nay, nay, I have indeed more to tell. Yet, O Eriol, the things that Gilfanan hath upon his lips are well worth the hearing. Indeed, never have I, nor any here, heard a full count of these matters. As soon, therefore, as may be, will I wind up my tale and make an end. But 3 nights hence, let us have another tale-telling, and it shall be one of greater ceremony, and musics there shall be, and all the children of the House of Lost Play shall here be gathered together at his feet, to hear Gilfanan relate the travail of the Noldoli and the coming of mankind." Now these words mightily pleased Gilfanan and Eriol, and many beside were glad. But now doth Lindo proceed. "Know then that to such vast heights did the sunship climb, and climbing blazed ever hotter and brighter, that ere long its glory was wider than ever the gods conceived of when that vessel was still harboured in their midst. Everywhere did its great light pierce, and all the vales and darkling woods, the bleak slopes and rocky streams lay dazzled by it, and the gods were amazed. Great was the magic and wonder of the sun in those days of bright Urwendi, yet not so tender and so delicately fair as had the sweet tree Laurelin once been, and thus whisper of new discontent awoke in Valinor, and words ran among the children of the gods, for Mandos and Fwy were wroth, saying that Aule and Varda would forever be meddling with the due order of the world, making it a place where no quiet or peaceful shadow could remain. But Lórien sat and wept in a grove of trees beneath the shadow of Taniquetil, and looked upon his gardens stretching beneath, still disordered by the great hunt of the gods, for he had not had the heart for their mending. There the nightingales were silent, for the heat danced above the trees, and his poppies were withered, and his evening flowers drooped and gave no scent. And Silmo stood sadly by Telimpe that gleamed wanly as still waters rather than the shining dew of Silpion, so overmastering was the great light of day. Then Lórien arose and said to Manwë, 'Call back your glittering ship, O Lord of the Heavens, for the eyes of us ache by reason of its flaming, and beauty and soft sleep is driven far away. Rather the darkness and our memories than this, for this is not the old loveliness of Laurelin, and Silpion is no more.' Nor were any of the